Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 8:58, Monday, February 15, 2010. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and we'll be joined here shortly with the other members. I'd just like to take a quick note to thank everybody for coming today for, as this is a holiday, and we have quite a schedule coming at us, so we don't want to lose a day. And also, the other body down the hall or on vacation this morning while the Senate labors, I just want you to take note of that here, so you don't think your time is wasted. We're going to have two bills on the agenda today. Senate Bill 269, Economic Stimulus Bonds, Reallocation and Waiver. And then the second order, Labor, Senate Bill 270, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Dividend. So we'll go ahead and start with the first item up, Senate Bill 269 by the Governor regarding recovery zone bonds. This is the first hearing on this bill, and the intent is to hear from the administration, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for now. With us today is Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, and Ted Lennard, the Executive Director of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. And Mr. Mitchell, if you could go ahead and introduce the bill and explain to the committee what we have before us. I'd like the record also to reflect that Senator Olson has arrived.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Devin Mitchell, and I'm here today acting in the capacity of the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. The bill before you today takes care of two different issues. The first relates specifically to the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority and some needed statutory revisions in that program for ongoing purposes, and then the other aspect of the statute relates to temporary opportunities related to the Recovery Act. You have a presentation that we've prepared today, and Mr. Leonard and I will be kind of shuffling through here, if you indulge us.
And if you could pull your mics in a little closer. And I know this is an exciting subject for a lot of us, so we don't want to miss anything you guys have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so we've already been through some of these slides with the committee last week when we went over the state overview of debt, and so I'm not going to belabor some of these. This is a slide relating to the bond bank. It's a public corporation of the state of Alaska created in 1975 to provide access to capital markets for Alaskan communities through the use of some state support. In the fiscal years from 2001 to 2009, the summary statistics are presented here on this slide, and the community savings are the amounts that the communities would have otherwise had to pay in addition to what they wound up paying for obligations with third parties. And so you can see that there are fairly significant benefits to Alaskan communities from the program. The statutes that are proposed relating to the bond bank increase the borrowing limit by $250 million. We currently have a $750 million cap. The cap was increased to $750 million 4 years ago. From $500 million, and so the $250 million increment is in line with historical increments. As of June 30, there was $162.8 million left of the existing $750 million cap, and we're, after this issue that we're selling this month, can be down to $120.5. We have applications for another $40 million right now, and expect to have some additional applications this year that would total about $100 million. And so without a change, we would be limited in fiscal year 2011 to consider additional loans.
Mr. Mitchell, if you could just kind of give us an idea on the previous slide, slide two, there's a list of outstanding loan amounts for the different communities around the state totaling $564 million, but give us a time frame of when some of these are going to be paid off, because my understanding, like the city and borough of Sitka's $34 million loan is going to be paid off here in 7 years or somewhere out in there. Then does that give you the ability then to take that authority that they had used up and then reuse it on another project?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is a revolving authority that exists under the borrowing cap. And so the program is fairly mature at this point, meaning that our debt is levelized and then stair steps down. If we had a slide showing our existing debt, it would continually step down to a zero balance out 30 years from today, since our most recent obligation was a 30-year final maturity. So there would be additional capacity. The borrowing of the communities has outpaced the maturity of the outstanding obligations.
And could you, as we're going to hear this bill today and then set it aside, could you kind of bring us back some additional information showing us that, how the authorization is going to step down, and so the committee can get an idea with the issue of the incremental increase to $250 million, how much actual room we're going to have out 5 years or 10 years?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
And then maybe also I'd like to have an idea of what the cost of this debt is to the communities. In this table, you've got a nice amount of loan outstanding and the percent of the total, but nothing showing on what the, you know, the communities, and it can be, you know, fairly accurate. I don't expect you to go in and spend a lot of time on it, but it'd be nice to get an idea of what is the interest cost that the, like for instance, the Northwest Arctic Borough is the first one on the list. You know, what is that interest cost that they're paying? What's, you know, Ketchikan Sewer right on down the line?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah, no, I could put together a schedule that shows the aggregate debt service of the program by community with our two maturities so that you'd be able to see how that looks over time. So the other, in addition to increasing the borrowing limit, the statute eliminates restrictions on revenue bond issues of the program, and it eliminates restrictions on leases of the program. And so those changes are requested by communities that currently have opportunities to finance capital projects where otherwise they would be doing these financings anyways and facing much higher costs without the bond bank program being available to them. And the for instance on that would be the city and borough of Sitka, which has a project that's possible. It's already been financed, a hydroelectric project, and that's the exclusion under our revenue bond statutes currently. The electric utility in Sitka is rated, triple B plus, I believe. And so they're looking at refunding or refinancing about $21 million worth of bonds. That refunding can benefit in gross dollars to the tune of about $1.7 million by the bond bank participating in the transaction at the credit rating level of AA minus A1. And so that's due to the what we talked about when we discussed the market issues last Friday. There's been a widening in credit spreads, and a triple B versus a low double A, high single A type credit is going to have a lot of value, and that's reflected in that potential. So
I think on a note on that one, just, you know, for general information at the table, what that particular community wants to do is refinance an old hydro project, lower their debt service, and then use the savings than to pay additional debt service for the next increment of raising a dam face. So they're not, just so people who are watching at home don't anticipate, especially from the community, anticipate their electrical rates changing. It's just a financing mechanism to go after the next incremental hydro project.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the increasing borrowing rate by $250 million, what kind of anticipated defaulting on for the, do you expect over the next 10 or 15 years, realizing we're in an economic roller coaster that kind of goes up and down, and certainly there are some high-risk loans that I see out there.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Olson, we expect to have zero defaults. The program isn't a grant program, it's a loan program. In the history of the bond bank, there hasn't been a default where a community has not paid debt service. There have been issues with communities, and we have worked hard to ensure that payments are made. And there's also a understanding that the intent of the program is that the legislature, when they set it up, wanted to provide lower costs to the communities that needed it most. And so where a community might be perceived as a little more risky from an outside perspective, based on some of the nuances that we're aware of, as an in-state facilitator of these loans, the credit is a little easier for us to take on.
Last question, Mr.
Go ahead.
Chairman. Senator Olson. Are all the on slide two, are all these communities in revenue into revenue bonds, or are there other type of bonds that are out there?
There's primarily general obligation and revenue bonds. And so, I mean, we could go down through this list and I could tell you what they primarily are, but
not necessarily. What's the rough breakdown? Are 50% revenue and 50% GO bonds?
It's more general obligation than revenue. It's probably 30 some percent to 60 some percent.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead. Continue, Mr. Devin.
Thank you. On slide four,
Mitchell, I should say.
We have the Recovery Zone Act that created the opportunities that we discussed last week, providing the incentives for both public and private partnerships. And there's a limited window of opportunity in as much as after the end of the calendar year, the allocations are no longer available for use. We talked about the Build America bonds last week, which are a structure of financing that are available for any tax-exempt financing. So where you otherwise would sell tax-exempt bonds, you now would sell taxable bonds. The federal government provides a 35% subsidy on your interest expense on those bonds. There's talk of an extension of this program, but at a lower subsidy rate in the Congress right now, and so it could drop to 28% subsidy, or it's, I guess, uncertain if it will even continue after the end of calendar year 2010, but certainly will be less valuable. The benefit on a 20-year financing in the 50 to 100 basis point range, depending on the market. And so then we get into the recovery zone bonds, and here we have first the economic development bonds, which are identical to the Build America bonds, but you get a boosted 45% subsidy on your interest expense. And so that increases the value pretty significantly on the long end of your loan. The last deal we did, there was a recovery zone economic development bond, 29-year maturity portion, as well as a Build America bond, 29-year maturity portion. And the incremental benefit for the 45% subsidy was about 50 basis points over and above the Build America bond benefit, so significant. $90 million has been allocated to the state of Alaska. Do you want to talk about recovery zone facility bonds, or you want me just to?
Why don't you head on and okay. I'll hit the recovery bonds.
Okay, we got it all figured out. So then the recovery zone facility bonds, again, we touched on them last week, but it's an opportunity for municipalities to partner with the businesses within their community and offer them tax-exempt financing for those projects that they otherwise would have had to pay taxable rates. There's $135 million allocated to the state of Alaska, and this opportunity could be as simplistic as a bank that has a relationship with a business and is looking to expand their business from through borrowing money from that bank, and the community says, hey, we can help increase the economic viability of this by offering up some of this allocation, and then the bank can have a tax-exempt rate rather than a taxable rate on that loan interest income, and accordingly reduce their required interest rate, and benefits the project, can benefit the financing, can benefit the community. Recovery zone, there's the legal definitions, but it's pretty much, at least in my experience, a community that declares itself a recovery zone. That it requires the local city council or assembly to pass a resolution that declares their community a recovery zone. It's a loophole, really. I mean, it's a requirement that they have to go through, but not something that any community in Alaska wouldn't be able to comply with.
Kevin, if I could just say. And for the recovery zones that were allocated, they were allocated in June of 2000.
Can you just identify yourself for the record?
For the record, my name is Ted Leonard. I'm with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. The recovery zones, I just wanted to point out the original zones that Devin will be going over in just a minute were allocated by the Treasury Department in June of 2008, or based on June of 2008 employment declines. So the U.S. Treasury looked at the cities and counties, and of course with Alaska, it was unique for them because they really didn't know what to do with the unorganized areas. So that's where they jumped into the census areas and allocated to the census areas, because in the lower 48, most of the states are based, of course, on counties and cities. So they could allocate based on the definitions in the statutes. But when they got to the Alaska and I believe Vermont, they came into areas that are unorganized, and that's when they went to the census areas to allocate a portion of the cap.
And there are the allocations on page 8, and they don't total on this page, but the economic development bond total is again $90 million, and facility bonds $135 million based on those employment statistics. And as Ted pointed out, we have a lot of allocation that right now we don't have a means of using. All of the census area allocations, there's not a governmental unit that can take advantage of those. And in addition, any borough that currently has an allocation, that doesn't need it. There's no methodology, there's no empowered body to reallocate that allocation.
This is could you help me a little bit with the bottom entry? Yukon, Koyukuk, and then a couple lines up the White Hampton, why they would be zero, and I think those are the two areas that struggle the most economically in the state.
I think it relates to that they didn't have a decline in employment statistics for that period. So while they might have had 40% unemployment or 60, whatever it is, it didn't increase during that particular time frame. Doesn't necessarily make sense, but it is the way it is. Well, we already kind of talked about this, but why the legislation, and that there's the disconnect between the allocations and potential projects. A failure to use the allocation simply means that we won't have an opportunity to use it for projects that are going to be financed anyways. And so this is just a means of making things that are going to be done anyway a little better. And the current allocations, we know based on all the census areas and some of the boroughs that there is a guarantee we're not going to be able to use a lot of the volume cap. and it establishes a framework and legal basis to make sure that we can take advantage. As far as the bond bank recovery zone statutes, it provides for the census areas, the communities in census areas, to receive consideration immediately upon the bills becoming effective. So if you look back on the list of communities where you go, okay, the Dillingham census area, well, maybe the city of Dillingham has a project, but right now their hands are tied. They can still finance the project, but at terms that are going to be a little bit better than what they could get if we could allocate some of these allocations to them. And you go down the list and that same thing. And so the bill right away would allow within that census area a sub-allocation down to a city within that census area that might need the cap. It provides for boroughs to waive their allocations immediately if they're not going to use them. I have talked to Richard Wallace in the Lake and Penn borough, and he indicated that they might not have a need for their economic development bond allocation. And so if that's in fact true, and the assembly is asked if that is in fact true, and they say, yeah, we're not going to be selling debt in the coming calendar year, they can waive their allocation and we can send it somewhere where they are going to be issuing debt in the coming calendar year.
Mr. Mitchell, if you can just stop there, let's just use an example. You've got Prince of Wales, Outer Ketchikan census area for $1.9 million in economic development bonds and $2.9 million in facility bonds. How does that mechanism work? Here's an example where we've got basically an island with numerous communities on it. Explain to us in simple language how this concept is going to would be applied.
So upon the bill's passage, there would be an immediate outreach to the communities that reside within the census area, querying whether there were capital projects those communities planned to finance. And if then based on the response to that inquiry, there would be an allocation to the communities that had projects. If there were competing projects, there would have to be some kind of methodology adopted by the boards of either the bond bank or ADA, depending on the allocation that you're talking about, to divvy up the allocation that does exist, or if there's allocations that's available from another census area or borough that has waived it. And then so that's, I guess, the first step. There's an additional provision in the bill that on June 30th, if a community, if a borough hasn't taken steps to use their allocation, that it will be deemed waived automatically. And again, it's because the clock is ticking here. We have till the end of the calendar year bond issues, and especially I think on the facility bond time, our bond side are going to take time to coordinate and structure. And so that deadline is required to ensure that there is an opportunity to refocus on other projects. And then the bill does proactively state again that the priority is for projects in the original allocation regions, meaning that it's, I think your larger issuers in the state are going to be the last, I don't know if it's the last resort, but it's going to ensure that the opportunity is taken advantage of. You would send the allocation outside of the regions, but you would first want to consider any request that came from the specific region that originally received the allocation. So just, I know there was a lot of concern that some of these areas that have experienced increases in unemployment in these recent years then would be penalized through legislation like this or through a reallocation where you say, okay, well, there was a need in those demonstrated by unemployment declines in those communities for this allocation, and then we're just going to take it and send it to, I mean, the big one is obviously Anchorage. And so that is clearly not the intent of the bill, but it is allowed by the bill at the end of the day to ensure that the allocations are in fact used.
I would just quickly like to go over what a recovery zone facility bond is. It's a little different than the economic development bonds. These bonds are specifically designed to be used with businesses. Again, like Devin said, one of the main ways that we see that these will be used with businesses in conjunction with banks. They can use for industrial, commercial, retail, office. And these bonds are mainly known for what they can't be used for. Exceptions are rental housing, airplanes, health clubs, can't be used to finance a massage parlor, and racetracks or luxury boxes in stadiums. So far, we do know of one allocation of $29 million by the Fairbanks North Star Borough to the Alaska Port Authority for their natural gas project. And that's all we know that have been used so far of the allocations.
Mr. Leonard, would
yes.
these be available for communities' fishing quotas? If they want to go out and buy buy a fishing quota for their communities?
To the chair, I'm not sure, but it doesn't say it can't be used for that, so we could verify that and look into the statutes. But I would assume that it could be used for rolling stock. One of the things that the only thing that I'm not sure how that would be used for is where you declare the recovery zone. Is going out into the ocean past the recovery zone or not? But we definitely could look into that and see if they can be used for that type of equipment.
So fishing permits, not really equipment, but
okay. Permits.
Because there is some discussion in the building by some other legislators of trying to use some funds to help some of the communities buy community quotas to create jobs. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not that I'm suggesting some of these exceptions be changed, but where is that addressed in the bill? I'm sorry, I was looking at something.
Oh, excuse me, through the chair to Senator Thomas. That's in the actual federal statutes that they can't be used for these type of activities.
Okay, thank you. I figured that was probably it.
And then very quickly, again, they're issued for private projects. The interest would be tax exempt. It's different from the economic development bonds and the fact that the issuer will not receive a payment back from the Internal Revenue Service. These are actually taxable bonds that can be sold for tax exempt. The rule of thumb that we've seen, and of course it's based on what type of project it is, but there's a difference between taxable and tax exempt financing of 150 to 200 basis points, so 1.5% to 2%. And again, as Devin said, these would likely be issued as conduit bonds, private activity bonds, and the debt service on these bonds, again, would be paid by the private entity that's using these bonds, and they would be responsible. So one of the keys and the challenges of the facility bonds, especially in the rural areas, we'll be able to find projects that can go through the rigor that you have to in issuing a bond and having the collateral or the revenue to ensure that the bonds are repaid. And then again, for us, on as we look at what type of regulations that we would need, the goal is to ensure that all the bonds will be used, that the criteria is for ensuring the allocations be used for areas of high unemployment and economic distress. And One of the benefits of this bill, of course, is that it does allow ADA and the bond bank to work with other entities that aren't in the recovery zone areas that were designated by the IRS, that new areas can be designated based on things like high unemployment, like the chair was asking with that one census area. So you can take what the IRS and the Treasury threw out there and we can modify it to better meet the state's needs. And
Senator Fuggers.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted, when you look at the state at large, and if we did a roll-up, I assume some states other than Alaska would qualify as a state at large to be able to do some projects. I don't know, Michigan, as an example, maybe Nevada. But do we, as a state, could we have statewide projects that was done through your organization or another?
Well, I think you would have to still, wherever the project would be, have to designate that as a recovery zone. But based on what we understand by the criteria the IRS has stated, that it pretty much just has to be logical and make sense. There's not a hard and fast rules on you have to have 10% decline in unemployment or that you have to show a certain type of distress. So it gives us the flexibility to look at statewide projects in different areas too. With, of course, like the bill stated, with priority to the areas that the original allocations were given to.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted, my concern is Mr. Mitchell said earlier when he was describing an element in the breakout, said it doesn't make sense. And my question is, at the end of the day, and we put the mechanisms into place, will it make sense for us later on when we're trying to justify it based on news headlines or whatever the case may be of the outcropping of this?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why the ADA is asking to be able to be part of this reallocation process, is that we do have the view of the state overall and that we do have the resources to look at the different areas, and we're working with, for example, the ARDRs and the municipalities, and that based on, you know, criteria that will go through a regulation process and a public hearing process, have a mechanism that we can stand with afterwards to show why we allocated where we allocated the cap to.
Follow-up?
Yeah, and one more follow-up. But let's say that didn't happen, okay? What's your confidence level in the mechanism to make this go with some coherency?
Let's see. Through the chair to Senator Huggins, if you're saying if it doesn't happen, and I think that's one of the reasons that we're here. You know, ADA estimates we'll lose at least 50% of the cap if we don't have a reallocation process. Pretty much every state does have a reallocation process, especially what you need to be able to do is first ensure that a project can meet the qualifications to be a project. One of the reasons why we've even put in a allocation fee on ADA's side is to make sure that the businesses are just not going to come and say, you know, we have this project that's sort of a pie in the sky type of project, and we'd like $5 million. With the processes put in place through regulation, we'd be able to verify that the project is feasible in the area that meets the criteria for unemployment or a distressed area, and also have the resources to monitor it to make sure that they will use the allocation. So there could be another in regulations that says if it isn't used by September or October 2010, that it would be pulled back again. And then ADA, like what Mr. Mitchell said, is hoping to have a list of projects that at the end, if the allocations aren't used, that we could fall back on to ensure that the whole allocation will be used.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So in a nutshell, the allocations that aren't used in the unorganized areas that don't have the capability of handling the debt issuance then would flow into Anchorage and Mat-Su.
It could, yes, well, through the chair.
It's most likely, I would say, the metropolitan areas that have the structure to handle it but didn't make the federal criteria.
Yes, there are, through to the chair, ways that, for example, with Anchorage, that you could look at areas, say, for example, like Mountain View, where you can actually, instead of what the IRS did, looking at Anchorage or Mat-Su in the whole, you can sort of tunnel in to certain areas that are distressed, and Anchorage, for example, could declare a recovery zone for certain areas in the metropolitan area, and the same with the Mat-Su.
Okay. Any other questions for the presenters? I think that concluded your slides, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, we've got a zero fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for eight operations, and a fiscal note from the Municipal Bond Bank and the Department of Revenue for $80,000 in Bond Bank retained earnings to cover the cost of legal counsel, financial advisory services, and travel. We have no one online. Okay, and I have no sign-up sheet. So apparently the enthusiasm has waned. So we'll come back to, is there anybody that wants to come forward and speak? Okay, we'll, from the audience, so we'll come back to the committee. Any final questions for the bill sponsors before we set this aside? Okay, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for a later date. Hopefully the committee members will give this bill and process some thought, and we'll figure out what we're going to do with this issue over the next few weeks. We'll have a brief at ease. This is a vacation. Everybody left but Johnny and myself.
They didn't catch the brief part.
Why should we fire? And come back on the record. We're going to go to our next item of labor today, Senate Bill 270, by the governor relating to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's dividend. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to introduce the bill, hear from the administration, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further review. With us today is from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is Mr. Brian Butcher, Government Relations and Public Affairs Director, and Joe Dubler, Chief Financial Officer, if they can come forward. We'll go ahead and take a look at this. And we'll be paying attention to the impact of the Alaska Housing dividend and that is paid to the state for this committee to allocate for capital projects and other issues. So you have our undivided attention, Mr. Butcher, if you want to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Director of Governmental Relations and Public Affairs for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. With me is our Chief Financial Officer, Director of Finance, Joe Dubler. And SB 270 will modify AHFC's transfer plan statutes to reflect changes in generally accepted accounting principles. To give a little bit of a background on the transfer plan, AHFC's transfer plan to the state, back in 2003, House Bill 256 was passed that put in statute that AHFC would pay a dividend of the lesser of $103 million or 75% of our net income on a yearly basis. When this bill was passed, we got an immediate rating upgrade from Standard & Poor's because it had been put in statute that we would have a set amount of dividend, and it could be read by the rating agencies and others specifically what we would be contributing. 3 years later, due to changes in generally accepted accounting principles, we came in with another bill very similar to this, a one-sentence bill that changed the words net income in statute to adjusted change in net assets, based on the changes that had been made to generally accepted accounting principles. And this is very similar to the bill that passed in 2006, where based on the most recent changes in generally accepted accounting principles, we would add to adjusted change in net assets to include temporary market value adjustments to assets and liabilities made during the base fiscal year. This change will allow for a true dollar figure for the corporation's dividend to be calculated rather than an inaccurately high or low number for a dividend in comparison to our adjusted change in net assets based on how interest rate swaps are now considered in the generally accepted accounting principles.
If you want to explain to the committee what an interest rate swap is, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Joe Dubler. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Finance Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. An interest rate swap is a derivative financial instrument whereby the corporation enters into a contract with a counterparty to where we pay them a fixed rate, and they in exchange pay us a variable rate. And the variable rate is based on an index. What it allows us to do is sell variable rate bonds and hedge the change in interest rates over the 30-year time period that we typically sell bonds and allow us to pay a fixed rate, which in the case of the interest rate swaps that the corporation has entered into to date has been in the range of 100 to 165 basis points below what the corporation could have got for a comparable fixed rate transaction. So we've been able to lower our cost of funds by entering into these interest rate swaps.
Good old derivatives, gotta love them. Sometimes. We'll go ahead and continue.
That's all we have, Mr. Chairman, unless there are questions. It's a fairly simple bill, once the description has been made on why we need to change slightly the wording in the statutes.
So have you had any problems with collections on your swaps or have any swaps that have turned upside down on you?
Mr. Chairman, currently our swaps, they mark them to market, or we mark them to market every quarter for financial statement presentation. And we're actually in a very good position now, and that's where they're in a negative market position. In other words, if we had to close the swap out today, we would have to make a payment to our counterparty. That may not sound like an ideal position until you consider the counterparty risk, and that's where, in the case of Lehman Brothers, if Lehman Brothers goes bankrupt, which they did a year and a half or so ago, if the corporation was in a position where Lehman Brothers owed us money, we would have to get in line with all the other creditors of Lehman Brothers. If we're in a position where we owe Lehman Brothers money, we just write them a check, bid the swap out again, and replace it with a comparable interest rate swap. So being in the position that we're in now, we don't have any counterparty risk.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at the low interest rates that are going on throughout, actually globally, who would want to go ahead and be involved in an interest rate switch like this? Do you have investors out there that are clamoring there, or is this just more of a move to try and preserve what we have before we lose more?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, these swaps were all entered into beginning in 2001 through about 2006 was the last one we entered into, and they were done at a time when the corporation saw the majority of our mortgage activity is to first-time home buyers, which are very unsophisticated borrowers. We saw the mortgage market at that time start offering very sophisticated loan products to all borrowers. They were the adjustable rate mortgages, interest-only mortgages, 40-year mortgages, a lot of fancy products that we were concerned about our borrower base, the unsophisticated first-time homebuyer getting involved in, not really understanding what they were getting involved in, and ending up having problems. What the corporation decided to do instead of offering those products to our borrowers was to go out and take the risk ourselves in the interest rate swap market, in the variable rate debt market, and in certain extent, some fixed rate market transactions that we entered into. the corporation felt, you know, staff and the board, that we have the financial expertise to execute those types of transactions and pass the benefit on to our borrowers in the form of a lower interest rate and attract them over, keep them with these products instead of the more risky ones. It turned out very well, I believe, in hindsight, as we've seen in the lower 48, what a lot of those products have done to borrowers. Left them in a position where their homes are underwater and they can't afford to make the increased payments. So, I mean, that's a long answer to a simple question, but the people in the market now that are looking to enter into these swaps, these are just a hedge. And a hedge, for instance, most for-profit corporations that rely on some type of raw materials enter into some sort of interest rate hedge. If you're making cornflakes, you're going to hedge the price of corn because you can't afford the fluctuations. The corporation's in the interest rate business, you know, so we've hedged interest rates. We sold variable rate debt and swapped them to a fixed rate, in most cases right around 3.5%. One of them is a little over 4, I believe it's 4.13%. So that's the fixed rate that we're paying, as opposed to a 30-year fixed income that we would have paid over 5%. So that's why we've entered into them. The opposite side is an entity that wants just the opposite exposure. They want to be able to have a variable rate exposure. In other words, they want debt that would have a variable rate exposure but not necessarily have variable rate bonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm not so sure on the, we haven't spent much time here at the committee looking at this stuff, but I'm not so sure that the counterparty risk, I think you made a comment that you've got virtually no counterparty risk. I'm not so sure the guys that were doing business with Lehman thought they had any counterparty risk until they imploded. So I don't know how much comfort level I should have in that statement, because I think there's a lot of firms that were caught by surprise dealing in the derivative market.
Mr. Chairman, that's true, and the corporation was one of them. We did have three swaps with Lehman Brothers, but like I said, we were in a position where we owed them money. So when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, we wrote them a check to purchase ourselves out of the position. We rebid the three swaps that we had with them, and actually the market moved in our favor in the 2 weeks it took us to rebid the swaps, and we made a several million dollars on the transaction. So it ended up working out very well for us.
I'm not sure if that's not just luck or just happenstance or what. We'll take the $7 million. We have one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue for zero on this bill. Do we have any questions? What questions for him? Senator Thomas, could you pull your mic in?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm reading this correctly, that it's only to be made during the base fiscal year. Is that correct? It's not something that's done on an annual basis or just whenever someone believes that there's a necessary adjustment to be made to an asset or a liability based on either reality or perception?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the adjustments to assets and liabilities will be made annually, and what it'll do is it'll make an adjustment from our financial statements to what was originally agreed to and the transfer plan. What's happened is the accountants have made a lot of changes over the years that have affected the agreement we had with the legislature and over what our actual dividend would be on an annual basis. In other words, they've changed things, put things into what we used to call the income statement, and now it's called a change in net assets. And they've put things into there that weren't originally in. So what we've done through these adjustments is back them out again to keep the deal the same. And that's all we're trying to do here, is the generally accepted accounting principles have been modified to require us to include changes in the market value of certain of our interest rate swaps. That wasn't part of the original deal we had with the legislature and in statute. So what we're asking to do here is to back that modification out.
Senator Thomas?
But wouldn't it be, it would be in broader than that, though, would it not, when you change this to just the swaps you're talking about, or is that the only instrument we're talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, that is not the only one we're talking about. That's the one that brought this all up. There was another modification in, I believe it was 1997, GASB 31, GASB's Governmental Accounting Standards Board, statement number 31, required the corporation to begin booking our marketable debt securities to market. That change was very immaterial to the corporation's financial statements. It's typically more than $1 million a quarter. So at the end of the fiscal year, like for instance, September of 2009, it was $400,000+. So we didn't feel that brought the issue to the necessary level to bring it to the legislature and make a modification to the plan. But the swap one could have very large swings in value from quarter to quarter. And what we didn't want to have happen is have a $10 million increase in net income in 1 year affecting our dividend, and then maybe a $10 million decrease in net income for the following year also affecting our dividend. That's what we're trying to avoid here, is to get those fluctuations out of the dividend calculation and make the dividend a much more stable number for everybody involved.
Okay, thank you.
And earlier you made mention that you guys haven't entered into interest rate swaps since 06, is that correct?
I believe that is the last one we did, Mr. Chairman.
And then what's your intention going forward dealing with derivatives?
Mr. Chairman, we currently have a portfolio of a little over $800 million in interest rate swaps. That's something that we're comfortable with. I don't see us entering into any more in the near future. The corporation's debt issuances for this calendar year will consist mainly of some federal ARRA funds or ARRA bonds that we intend to issue through the end of calendar year 2010. The interest rate swaps, I feel our portfolio is adequate, and I would not see us doing any more in the near future.
And the reason you don't want to do any more in the near future, kind of elaborate on that. Clearly this marketplace has been bombed out, so literally. So why did you stop in 06 and give us a little more detail on what you're referring to?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. The interest rate swaps we've entered into to date have been swaps that change basically a variable rate debt into a fixed rate obligation of the corporation. The variable rate debt market in the United States, and I believe the world, has had some issues with liquidity in the past year and a half. The corporation's bonds as well, where we've had a lot of bondholders that put the bonds back to the corporation, and we had to come up with the cash to pay off their position. The variable rate interest rate market today for debt issuance is almost non-existent because of the shortage in liquidity. So for us to be able to enter into a swap, if we were to enter into a variable to fixed rate swap, we would have to sell variable rate debt. That market isn't available to us today at reasonable levels. The last liquidity facility we entered into was in September of 2009, and the annual fee we paid was 1.2% to provide liquidity for that transaction. That makes a transaction like the ones that we've entered into in the past not in the corporation's best interest. We would not enter into that.
So are these standardized contracts or non-standardized arrangements?
Mr. Chairman, the general terms are standardized, but each firm has their own little tweaks they want to put on. And, you know, anytime you deal with a different law firm, they've got their way of doing business. We have our standard way we like to have contracts, and we make our best attempt to make sure that they all fit within that mold. But there's sometimes that the provider will insist on terms that we haven't used in the past.
And maybe you can. Some of us are more familiar with these instruments than others at the table, so maybe you can take a little bit of time and explain to the committee members why we should be concerned if it's a standardized or non-standardized arrangement.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming we're talking about the liquidity facilities?
Right, and the swaps.
Okay, the liquidity facilities are an agreement whereby a provider, in most instances it's a bank. There are some Federal Home Loan Banks that have done this. Fannie Mae has done it. Freddie Mac has done it. They provide liquidity for a variable rate debt obligation. In other words, the corporation sells, in the case of the last transaction we did, approximately $81 million in variable rate bonds, the bondholders of which have the right every 7 days to put the bonds back to the corporation. They come back and say, I would like my money back for my bond. The corporation has to have at its disposal $81 million on any given day to pay those bonds off. So since we don't have that kind of cash just laying around and we don't want to keep that kind of cash laying around, we enter into an agreement in the case of the last transaction with Bank of America to pay, to provide the liquidity in case a bondholder does that. The standard terms in those agreements, I mean, there's default provisions where if the corporation defaults on the bonds, the bank is let out of the agreement. There's obviously default terms for if Bank of America goes into default, we can get out of the agreement. And the other ones are just, quite honestly, a lot of legal boilerplate. I mean, there's a lot of that in these transactions. The swap transactions, they are set up, every one of them has what's called an ISDA, and that's a standard agreement, and that's International Swaps and Derivatives Association, I believe is the acronym what that stands for. Those are standard agreements that every single interest rate, every single actually derivative instrument has, and they're all the same. What follows the ISDA, the standard contract, is a confirmation which details the individual attributes of each transaction that's entered into. So if we have three different transactions with one firm, we would have one ISDA and three different confirmations that delineate the actual terms of each of the new contracts. So there's a standard portion of each, and there's also a portion that changes with every transaction.
Okay. We have any more questions for him? Just so we don't. I hear what you're saying as far as the standardization, and everybody kind of understands the game with each other, and I certainly am clear that in 06 you guys have, you know, gone on and haven't done interest rate swaps, but clearly the transparency within that arena wasn't as transparent as a lot of people thought. Case in point is the financial implosion. So that's why, you know, our comfort level anytime we get even close to this area isn't high. Even though I recognize the state of Alaska, you know, didn't get hit like other areas of the country, but still for us to not recognize that there's a huge issue out there. And I guess that industry is dynamic and the Congress is trying to deal with it and so on and so forth. But it's not a inconsequential little sideline that has huge impacts. Do we have any no call-ins? And we have anybody from the audience want to come forward? I just, for those at home, I just see the administration and a few of the people that are here quite often. So, Senator Thomas, you have another question?
Yeah.
Do you have any closing comments before we set the bill aside?
Nothing,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. Tomorrow, be the 16th at 9 a.m., we're going to begin our overview of oil and tax structure. It'll go on morning and afternoon. We have Friday afternoon as a spillover to stay on track, and then we'll pick back up again a week from Monday. Tomorrow we're going to, as I recall, we're going to look at production, and we're going to look at employment. We're going to have one section on transportation, one on leasehold expenses, one on credits. We're trying to put this in a kind of a group process to make as much orderly sense out of it as we can as we build on it. And then a week from today at the table here, we'll go ahead and have our potential gas revenue from a hypothetical gas line constructed flowed into our tax structure, existing tax structure, to see the results so we can get an idea of what we're dealing with. Any final comments? See everybody tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.